U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Elon Musk releases a cache of Twitter emails and documents relating to its censorship in 2020 of political content, in particular of the New York Post story on Hunter Biden's laptop and emails. What do these newly revealed documents tell us about Twitter's thinking at the time, and in particular the coordination with the Biden campaign and the role of the Federal Bureau of Investigation? Plus, Donald Trump responds to that news by demanding that the Constitution be terminated. That's his word. We'll talk about that as well. Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot, here with Kim Strassel and Kyle Peterson. Now, most of the press is ignoring the Twitter censorship files, but not us, and we want to talk about them. Now that he owns Twitter, Elon Musk is cleaning out the censorship files. He dumped a number of revealing emails and documents late Friday on journalist Matt Taibbi's Twitter feed. The documents reveal coordination with the Biden campaign to suppress certain Twitter feeds, including that of the actor James Woods. And they reveal how Twitter decided to suppress the New York Post story about Hunter Biden's laptop, claiming it might have been hacked or be Russian disinformation. First, Kim, why do you think Musk is going through Matt Taibbi here and not simply releasing everything all at one time so everyone can see and make their judgments about the news value?
Well, I really wished he would. It struck me that what Musk wanted to do here was provide a sort of narrative. And so he chose a journalist who has been very critical of attempts to censor speech. And he had Matt Taibbi put this out in a tweet string that attempted to kind of put the meat on the bones, as it were, and say, this is what was happening. And then this official weighed in and give names and try to provide some context. And so turn it a bit more into a story, albeit with snippets and certain links to documents. I think the problem with that is that, first of all, it's allowed the media to ignore this story to a certain degree because they claim that they can't confirm any of the arguments that Taibbi is making because the underlying documents aren't always there. I think it's also unfortunate in that it's cloaked other people's ability to sort of really see what was going on. And at a certain point, it would be good to just dump it all out there. It might be messy. There might be some confusion, but you'd probably end up with a lot more transparency and people would be more trusting of the argument that Musk is trying to make here.
Right. I assume that if the House Republicans in the new Congress hold hearings, that they'll subpoena a whole heck of these documents and some of the individuals involved.
Absolutely. And in putting this out there, and that's a very interesting point, Musk has essentially declared that an invitation almost to do that. It would be very difficult, also not to say unlikely, that the company would now fight such a subpoena, given that they've already authorized a certain amount of disclosure.
We should add that Matt Taibbi is hardly a right-wing journalist. He's a real left-winger, in fact. But on the issue of censorship and the First Amendment, he's a hawk as much as we are. So in that sense, he's highly credible here, at least in my estimation on this subject. Kyle, you've looked at the documents and the flurry of coverage about them. What do you take away from it?
Well, the biggest takeaway for me is that this decision by Twitter to ban the New York Post story on Hunter Biden's laptop was basically them making it up as they went. One thing that I think is notable, this is from Matt Taibbi. He says, several sources recalled hearing about a general warning from federal law enforcement that summer about possible foreign hacks. There's no evidence that I've seen of any government involvement in the laptop story. And so I think that is a notable piece here. But it does seem like they hadn't really thought all this through. There's some internal emails where Twitter officials are saying they're struggling to understand the policy basis for marking this as unsafe. There's some suggestion that this did not even get all the way up to Jack Dorsey. It was made by...
who was the former CEO of the time he was CEO of Twitter.
Correct. And so it seems like they didn't really have their ducks in a row, that they were worried about Russian disinformation, and they made the bad call, I think, to ban the New York Post story. The thing that I think we're still waiting for is evidence of real government involvement and coercion on these social media sites. I mean, earlier this year, this fall, I looked at a bunch of emails, hundreds of pages of emails between federal officials And Twitter and Facebook, these emails involved, for example, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And so there were emails to Twitter flagging things as COVID disinformation, things like vaccines have microchips in them. There were emails going the other direction where the CDC was asking, we're seeing this claim surfacing a lot. Do you have any information about whether it's true or not? And so I think the smoking gun would be something where there's a federal official making some sort of implied threat if Facebook or Twitter doesn't act the way that the government wants them to. And that is what I think we're still waiting to find out.
Well, that's the fascinating subject here, because as a private entity, Twitter has the ability to censor what it wants. It's not governed by the First Amendment per se. That controls that the government can do. But there is some case law and a couple of Supreme Court precedents that if a private entity is acting essentially as an enforcer for the government, then therefore it could bring First Amendment implications. And that some of the coordination with the Biden campaign that we've seen in these some of these emails suggests a voluntary cooperation by Twitter. On the other hand, remember, this is an administration, it was a campaign, and they could have won the election. And then if you're sitting there as a private person working for Twitter and you say, I'm sorry, we can't do that, we're going to keep James Woods on, we're going to keep the New York Post on, then do you fear retribution, Kim? And I think that's a very realistic question to pose.
Yeah, absolutely. I take a little bit different view of this. I think the story here, one of the biggest stories, is not just the very shoddy reasons that Twitter used to decide that they were going to shut this story down, but indeed the communications that it was having with exceptionally powerful political figures, people who, even if they didn't immediately hold office, very likely had the prospect of holding office and therefore the ability to take retribution and action against Twitter if it didn't do what they said. And what really jumps out in these Twitter files is the direct lines of communication that these political figures had to senior Twitter officials and the ease with which they had their demands satisfied. Literally, there's one where a request comes through to someone that says, here's five more links from the Biden campaign. And the response from someone at Twitter is handled, meaning those people were all censored essentially at the request of senior people in a major presidential political campaign. And this gets to what you're saying, Paul, is that yes, Twitter is a private entity. And I definitely believe that it has rights to make its own decisions about what it does or doesn't. But you would feel a lot more comfortable if its attitude was hostility toward any government actor that was asking it to censor something. Then you might feel a little bit more confident in the decisions it made. But that is not the situation here. This is a sort of two-way avenue here where there's lots of cooperation going on. A lot of it seems to be favoring one side of the aisle.
And the implicit threat, of course, the leverage the government would have over a platform like Twitter is the existence of Section 230, which allows, is a federal statute, which gives the social media sites a liability protection from lawsuits if they do exercise their discretion to edit or to censor. And of course, that's in many respects a good thing when it comes to child pornography, when it comes to inciting terrorism or violence. But when it becomes a justification for banning news stories at a major newspaper like the New York Post, that becomes a different thing. And we should add that the New York Post hasn't been entirely vindicated as a factual matter here. The Hunter Biden emails and the laptop were real, and the Post was entirely correct in posting them. And the fears that they were somehow Russian disinformation have proven to be false at the time. Now, one interesting point, Ro Khanna, the congressman, a progressive Democrat from California, is in one of the documents suggesting a caution to the chief Twitter censor, saying to her that, you know, this is getting quite a bit of backlash here, Kyle, from the press. You got to be careful because this has First Amendment implications. So Khanna, to me, looks like the stand-up guy here, and the Twitter folks not nearly as principled.
I agree with that. I mean, the other point that Ro Khanna made was that we're talking about a newspaper article here. His line was, restricting dissemination of newspaper articles in the heat of a presidential campaign will invite more backlash than it will do good. And I think that's true. The other caution I would add, though, is that I'm not surprised to see press secretaries emailing Twitter and flagging posts that they think should be taken down. And the difficulty is that a lot of this stuff really runs the gamut. So one of the posts that was allegedly flagged here by the DNC, according to these emails, if you go back and look at it, it appears to have included a nude photo of Hunter Biden. And it's blurred a little bit, but it really should be blurred a whole lot more. And so that's something that Twitter, even if it were not a politician's son, would probably have taken down under its policy against non-consensual nudity. And so I think the details really matter here, A, on what the posts were that were being asked to take down, what the response rate was from Twitter. I mean, there's no evidence that we're still waiting on evidence, I guess, to see if there are examples of where Twitter left things up that were being flagged. And then I would also add that Matt Taibbi also says that both parties had access to these tools in 2020. Requests from both the Trump White House and the Biden campaign were received and honored. And so that suggests to me that it's kind of a complicated story, and there may be instances where Democrats are having an easier time getting these takedown requests looked at, in part because the Twitter office is full of fellow Democrats. But it does look like it's a complicated story. Both sides were doing this, and if you have a professional press secretary, I would be surprised if they weren't.
All right, well, I'm going to take issue with that a little bit when we come back from a break. We'll talk more about the Twitter censorship files and the consequences when we come back.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Kyle Peterson and Kim Strassel, talking about the Twitter censorship files and the reaction to them. Kyle, you mentioned the nudity point about Hunter Biden. Well, of course you can cover that up or make sure it's not spread all over the internet. Seems to me an easy call. But we're talking about they censored a newspaper article that basically had everything right about Hunter Biden and emails with implications in the middle of a presidential campaign about Hunter Biden's relations, business dealings with a foreign government, and potential implications of Joe Biden knowing about Hunter Biden's dealings with China and maybe being a beneficiary. How do you censor that for other than political purposes?
Well, I'm not defending the censorship of that. Jack Dorsey, Twitter's former CEO, has admitted that it was a mistake and apologized for it, I think. I mean, I think what they would say is that they were concerned about Russian interference. And so there was this all the stuff surfacing, allegedly from Hunter Biden. I think one really blameworthy party here is these U.S. spies who put out a really prominent people who put out a letter saying that this Hunter Biden stuff had all the signs of Russian spy tradecraft. And so I think what they would say in their defense is that they're relying on that. And obviously they were wrong because the New York Post has been vindicated and other news outlets have gone through and verified to the extent that it can be what was on that laptop. And there's been nothing that has surfaced to suggest that the provenance of the laptop that has been described, which is that Hunter Biden left it and abandoned it at this laptop repair shop, there's been no disputing that as far as I know. What I'm just trying to suggest is that it gets a little more complicated, especially when you're getting into the question of whether it's appropriate for politicians or prominent figures to be flagging things about them to Twitter that they think are violations of the Twitter rule.
Well, complicated or not, I take your point that, you know, press secretary's job is to flag something like that. But Twitter's job is actually not to do their bidding and not to be intimidated to do their bidding. Now, Kim, I want you to elaborate a little bit on the 51 former spies who signed that public statement on October 19th, 2020, claiming that their view was that the Hunter emails published by the Post were probably a, quote, Russian information operation. This exercise was led by James Clapper and John Brennan, two former highly partisan Democratic intelligence officials. And it looks to me, when you look at documents from Twitter, that their framing, that these former spooks' framing of the issue as potentially Russian information did give a kind of justification for Twitter, an excuse, if you will. I would say justification is probably too kind to Twitter, excuse to suggest that they could censor this. And the reason I say this is because James Baker makes an appearance here. James Baker, deputy general counsel of Twitter at the time, formerly James Comey's counsel at the FBI during the Russian collusion scheme of 2016. And he writes a document that comes out in the Twitter censorship file suggesting that, well, we don't know if the emails were hacked, but there's some evidence that they might have been hacked, so therefore we should proceed with caution. And of course, by caution, he means, well, let's not suggest that he meant let's be cautious in how we allow these to be disseminated.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is the Russian disinformation crew that has known all along that this is bogus. Yes, does Russia interfere in some things? Sure. But the whole Baker and Clapper and Brennan constituency had figured out 2 years prior to this in 2020. The power of this is certainly in the political realm because they were the folks that brought us the collusion narrative that so obsessed the nation for several years and hung a cloud over the Trump administration. So the Post comes out with this. Twitter comes out with its justification, saying it's possibly hacked material. Twitter's getting enormous pushback on this because they know it's pretty bogus. The New York Post has a very credible story as to how they'd obtain this laptop. One more thing I would point out that if that wasn't enough, around this time, Hunter Biden's former business partner, a guy named Tony Bobulinski, came out and corroborated that these texts and emails were true because he had them on the other end. We wrote about it. So you had a firsthand witness confirming that what was on this laptop was real. And yet in walk all these former spies, 51 of them, they knew that what they were writing was bogus, but they knew that it would give Twitter the cover it needed to continue censoring this, as well as other social media groups. Remember that Facebook was also pushing it down so that not as many people could see it. And it also gave the media the excuse they need to write it all off and not cover the story. So, I mean, it's all a big cloud, but you see a lot of central figures appearing again and again with the same tired old argument that the press just credibly swallows, even though we should have known far better by that point.
Very disturbing to me to have these former spies, many of them at the very highest levels of U.S. intelligence, telling the American public that, oh, well, this is all probably just Russian disinformation. It is a political foray intervention into a campaign. Certainly, they have the First Amendment right to do it. But the fact that intelligence officers didn't used to behave this way, they used to show some discretion because they have access to information and a certain authority that comes with their former position that is impossible for any of us to double check. We don't have security clearances. We can't look. We can't check. This is why when somebody like Adam Schiff, chairman of the Intelligence Committee, lies flat out about what he claims he knew about Russian disinformation, that this is an outrage. So I think this very much warrants investigation, and I hope it happens. Now, before we go, I want to talk about Donald Trump's response here. Because Donald Trump issued a statement in which he said that in response to the news about the Twitter files, do you throw the presidential election results of 2020 out and declare the rightful winner, or do you have a new election? A massive fraud of this type and magnitude allows for the termination of all rules, regulations, and articles, even those found in the Constitution. So Donald Trump, once again, belly flops into all of this. And let's listen to a couple of responses, one by the new Democratic House leader, Hakeem Jeffries, followed by Republican David Joyce on ABC's This Week.
I thought it was a strange statement, but the Republicans are going to have to work out their issues with the former president and decide whether they're going to break from him and return to some semblance of reasonableness or continue to lean into the extremism, not just of Trump, but of Trumpism.
Suspending the Constitution.
Suspending the Constitution is an extraordinary step, but we're used to extraordinary statements being made by the former president.
Whoever the Republicans end up pick, I'll fall in behind because that's... Even if it's Donald Trump and he's called for suspending the Constitution?
Well, again, I think it's going to be a big field. I don't think Donald Trump's going to clear out the field like he did in 16.
That's not what I'm asking. I'm asking you, if he's the nominee, will you support him?
I will support whoever the Republican nominee is. And I just don't think that at this point he'll be able to get there because I think there's a lot of other good quality candidates out there.
That's a remarkable statement. You'd support a candidate who's come out for suspending the Constitution?
Well, you know, he says a lot of things. You have to take him in context. And right now, I have to worry about making sure as a Republican governance group and a Republican majority that we make things work for American people. And I can't be really chasing every one of these crazy statements that come out about from any of these candidates.
Kyle, you can see there that the statement by the president allowing George Stephanopoulos to change the subject, talk about Trump and his statement to suspend the Constitution, which, of course, you can't do, short of a coup d'etat, which even for Mar-a-Lago, he can't stage. Even when he was in the White House, he wouldn't have been able to stage. So he gives the media a chance to say, okay, let's make this the story and ignore the Twitter censorship and the FBI's role in that.
And I think that's what he wants. I mean, he is running for president, and he seems to be losing his grip after the poor showing of some of his candidates in the recent elections. He seems to be losing his grip on the Republican Party. And so what does he want to do? He wants to stay in the news, on top of the news. We've had a long history of this now, of President Trump making some sort of outlandish statement that makes the headlines the next morning and gets everybody riled up and leads to basically nothing, as this will. I would bet that even President Trump knows there's no way to terminate the rules in the Constitution. The other thing that just strikes me about this is he's talking about how this proves that it was a massive and widespread fraud and deception, fraudulent elections. And it doesn't matter. I mean, he says that no matter what the arguments are. First, it's the Dominion voting machines, then it's the mail ballots. And now we're getting into, you know, social media censorship somehow means a fraudulent election. Media bias means a fraudulent election. I don't think that that is what a fraudulent election is. I mean, every Republican presidential candidate in my lifetime has faced media bias, and some of them have won and some of them have lost. And none of them except Donald Trump have claimed that that is the basis for saying that the election was stolen.
Kim, you have any thoughts on the president's belly flop into this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's classic Donald Trump. But, you know, I think he's doing himself great harm. And by the way, among the people that he needs. Look, he's running for president again. And what has been remarkable to me since the moment he made the decision to get back in is how tepid a lot of Republicans have been about that. And this is a different go-round than the first time. People didn't really know what they were getting with Donald Trump. There was a lot of pushback, obviously. He ended up consolidating the party. That's not going to happen as easily this time. And so when the president makes these statements, he might think that, oh, he's rallying his base, but he is making the folks in Washington a lot more willing to break with him because they're very concerned about the level of stability there. And I think that this redounds to the benefit of some of the other Republicans who are thinking about making a run, and it only encourages them all the more that there's an opening there.
All right. Thanks, Kim. Thanks, Kyle. And thank you all for listening. And don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast. That is, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast. Of course, we're here every day on Potomac Watch, so thanks for listening, and we hope you're with us tomorrow and the rest of the week. Thank you.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.